for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. For most of the 15,000 years since dogs were domesticated, they've been valued for the work they could perform for people. By the 20th century, they had evolved into full-fledged members of the family. When the birth of the world's first cloned sheep was announced in 1997, the race to clone a canine began. In a new book titled Dog Inc., Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter John Westendick tells the inside story about the science, the ethics, the marketing, and often the quirky personalities involved in pet cloning. He joins me here in this studio, and we're delighted to take your calls. I'm interested in hearing your reactions to the story that John tells. Call us with your comments on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org and join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to you. It's good to have you here.
Good morning. I'm thrilled to be here.
I'm interested in the fact that you won the Pulitzer in 1987 for a series of articles that helped overturn a murder conviction of an innocent 18-year-old man who had been sentenced to life in prison. How in the world did you get from that
to dogs,
and dog cloning?
How I got to dogs was, I've always been into dogs, and pretty much I've always had one. But I went through like a 2-year period without a dog, and adopted one from the shelter in Baltimore, Barks, it's called. And after I did that, I kind of got interested in his heritage, his story, which was a mystery, where he might have come from and what he was, because at least 100 times a day I get asked, you know, what kind of dog is that?
Sure.
So I embarked on a quest to find his roots, sort of.
And did you?
I turned to science and did one of the DNA tests that you can do now to pinpoint what breeds are in your dog.
Okay.
And I've actually done that 3 times, all in connection with writing stories about it. But they were all a little bit different, but they concluded he was Rottweiler, Akita, Chow, and some studies have some pit bull in him too.
Big dog.
He's a very big dog. He's 130 pounds.
I see.
But That was part of it. Then I went back to the shelter and tried to get what information they had on where he had come from. And then went back to the neighborhood where he was found as a stray before he was brought into the shelter. And ended up writing an overly long series of like 7 parts about, you know, my dog's roots. And one part of it was going to an animal communicator to get her to talk to my dog and get my dog to tell her where he came from. So.
And what did the dog communicator indicate?
She said he was in a family with kids, and this was in Baltimore, and she thought, or he told her, that the family expected him to be a pit bull, and then as he got older and didn't look at all like a pit bull, they decided to get rid of him, and he was like taken out in the country,
sort of dumped,
let out of the car.
Wow.
And then
gotta tell you, John, this sounds pretty weird, but the story gets even more
weird, doesn't it?
So you decided you wanted to have this dog cloned?
No. I knew very little about cloning at that point. Probably what I knew was mostly from science fiction movies. But because of my interest in dogs, the Baltimore Sun, where I was working at the time, asked me if I wanted to start doing a blog. It was at the time where all the newspapers were trying to churn out as many blogs as they could, a pet blog. And I said, well, I'll do a dog blog. Occasionally mention cats, but mainly a dog blog, and mainly feature focused on mutts as opposed to purebred and the whole dog fancier thing, just, you know, basic regular dogs. And I resisted it, the idea of blogging at first, and sort of made it a condition that I'd do the blog, but if only if they let me like also do some serious dog stories, because I don't think the news media historically has given much respect to dogs. It's always, you know, little cutesy, fluffy stories, and, you know, send us your pet pictures. And there's a place for that, but it's not what I wanted to be doing. That has sort of changed, I think, in the last few years with Michael Vick and dog food recalls and more serious stories surfacing. So they said okay, and so I sort of just focused on dogs for like 6 months and started up the blog, which was called Mutts. And that through that is how I eventually got into the whole cloning thing. A reader of that, I had done a small item on cloning, dog cloning, you know, very brief, like blogs normally are. And I got a call from the anonymous, up until then, woman who was the first customer signed up to get her dog cloned. And she left me a series of phone messages. Each, she'd use up all the time on the message and then call back and start back up.
Use
and
more.
Almost an hour of her,
oh
her
gosh,
life story, which was sort of how I got
really quite
to step
something
into the whole thing.
Did she, in fact, you did get in touch with her, and the story went from there?
Yeah, I ended up doing like a real newspaper story on the topic, and which sort of focused on how it had reached the stage where it was being marketed to the public now. And it was her story and some of the other customers.
But the first dog cloning was actually done in South Korea.
Right.
And that was a dog belonging to an individual, or were they just taking any dog to try to create another dog?
That was Snuppy, was the first canine clone, and the donor dog in that case was a dog named Ty, who was belonged to a veterinary student at Seoul National University.
And it was an Afghan hound.
Yeah.
And when you say the donor dog, give us an idea of how this worked.
Okay, in very layman terms, because I'm no scientist. Basically, they get a cell sample from the dog to be cloned. Then they get egg cells from a female dog in estrus and isolate those and enucleate them, or take out their nucleus, and then through a little tiny slit put in the cell of the donor dog. Then it's a matter of like zapping it with electricity to make them fuse, and then wait for them to start dividing. But you don't, they don't wait very long. And then they put it into a surrogate mother dog. So there's actually lots of dogs involved in cloning. And they have to do it lots of times to get it to work successfully.
So it's very close to the human process of treating someone with infertility, only this time you've got a certain dog in mind that you're trying to reproduce. How close to the original is or was Snuppy?
Snuppy, in appearance, was very close to the original. I talked when I went over there. I met Snuppy, and Snuppy has, you know, for 5 years now, I guess, been, you know, lived in the laboratory, still lives there. And so he's not real social growing up in that setting. But I met Snuppy, and then I talked to the guy who, the former student, who's now a professor there, who sort of begrudgingly went along with the whole thing. He didn't want his dog cloned, but with like a superior professor making the request, he said he sort of felt like he couldn't say no, because, you know, Korean culture and respect for elders and things like that. So he says that they look alike, but they're not really at all alike in terms of their behavior. Snuppy I think he gets outside like 3 times a day, but otherwise, you know, lives in the lab, and so he moans. He kind of, you can, even before I met him, I could like hear his kind of eerie moans that he makes, and so Ty, the donor dog, was more, you know, socialized. Huh.
Well, living in lab, I can certainly understand why poor Snuffy doesn't have very friendly feelings toward people. John Westendick is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. His new book, all about the cloning of dogs that first began in South Korea and then certainly migrated to this country, is called Dog Inc. And if you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850, that's the number to call. When you think about what's been done to dogs and to dog owners in this process of cloning, is the ultimate goal to actually reproduce the same dog emotionally as well as physically?
That's the hope of the owners, and it was sort of the promise of the companies. The companies never really guaranteed anything more than physical resemblance, but you know, they also sort of pushed, you know, the whole getting your dog back. You know, you can have your dog back again early on.
And we'll take a short break. We'll talk more about whether you can get your dog back. When we come back, Dog Inc. is the name of the book. Welcome back. John Westendick is with me. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, formerly with the Philadelphia Inquirer. His new book is titled Dog Inc., The Uncanny Inside Story of Cloning Man's Best Friend. And here on the cover is a beagle, a sweet, darling little beagle. And did anybody try to clone a beagle?
I don't know of a beagle. Well, for laboratory purposes, not for a, I don't know of a customer that has had a beagle cloned, though I'm not up on all of them. But beagles are traditionally dogs used for research in laboratories, and they're, so they're bred to go, you know, to live their lives in laboratories. In that
case, here's an email from Keith who says, This American Life had a show about a guy who cloned a beloved bull. The clone was different and almost killed him. You write about that story in the book. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, there's 2 chapters about Chance and his clone's second chance. And this was a bull owned by a man in Texas, LaGrange, Texas, named Ralph Fisher, who is a former school teacher and former rodeo clown, and started a company that makes use of animals, mainly Texas-type animals, for events, sort of corporate events. And he takes, so you could have your picture taken on top of a bull, or, you know, for parades, and has like armadillo races and He has a very famous buzzard also that's been in a lot of movies. But it's Ralph Fisher's Photo Animals, I think it's called. But he had a bull named Chance that originally had a bull named Tumbleweed that was unusually calm for a bull. And he's the bull that, you know, he would have people get their pictures taken on. And Tumbleweed was sort of the star of his show. And then a friend of his ran into another bull called Chance and bought him with the idea of giving him to Ralph. And Ralph eventually picked up Chance, who was a Brahmin bull, which are even more notoriously unpredictable. And he had, you know, serious doubts whether Chance would ever be calm enough to be a photo animal. But Chance turned out to be like, he became pretty much their pet. And so in a way, he was the first pet cloned. That's why he's in the book.
And this is a bull with horns, be clear.
Yeah, this is a monster of a bull. Yeah. And it's like, and it was like, goes back, it was an early Brahmin bull, how they used to look before, through selective breeding, they sort of made them a little smaller and meatier and less saggy skinned. But Chance was getting up in years, and he had a mole that Ralph wanted to get removed because checked out in case it was a sign of, you know, something wrong. So he sent Chance to Texas A&M University, which was sort of the place to take your animal. And while Chance was there, he heard about the dog cloning project that had just started at Texas A&M, which was being funded by a billionaire who supposedly wanted his dog cloned. And so he called the scientists involved with that project and said, you know, well, why don't you go ahead and clone Chance while you have him there? And pressed him to do it pretty hard, but never got a response one way or the other, whether they were doing it. But then several months later, he got a call and found out that Chance had indeed been cloned from the mole, actual mole, and there was pregnancies and a birth was imminent. And a few months after that, Second Chance, as they named him, was born.
I'm looking at a photograph, 1998, with Chance, with the original Chance. And there are two young children on top of him, a family behind him. He was clearly a loving bull. And then there's a photograph of Fisher with Second Chance, hugging Second Chance, who I gather was, for the most part, pretty mild.
For the most part. Not entirely.
But the third photograph shows Ralph Fisher with the jeans he was wearing on the two occasions that Second Chance attacked him. Yeah. What happened?
Well, Ralph was sure that Second Chance was going to be was Chance back again, and therefore was going to be the same gentle soul that the original Chance was, but he when Second Chance was maybe 3 or 4 years old, there was an incident where he came after Ralph, and then several years after that, and this was actually while This American Life was there. And they were filming like a pilot. They were making transition for the show to be a pilot for TV. While they were there, came the second attack by Second Chance on Ralph came, and he got, you know, pretty badly gored and thrown up in the air and pinned down. And actually, you know, one of his testicles was just hanging down by his knees. And he had to go to the hospital and get something like 80 stitches. But after the first attack and after the second one, he still said, you know, it's a fluke. It was my fault. I did something wrong, and to get him riled up. And he still thought that Second Chance was going to be the same gentle one that Chance was. And this was despite the scientists all along. Scientists were kind of getting upset with Ralph because Ralph was saying, you know, Chance has been reincarnated, and scientists didn't like him using that word and said it's not the same thing. It's reproduction. It's not resurrection or reincarnation. But he, even after both attacks, he still felt that Second Chance was gonna be gentle enough. And Second Chance was never used for the photo shows. He was more exhibited as a clone than an animal you could climb up on and get your picture taken on. And he was kind of waiting, because he got the original Chance when he was seven. He was kind of waiting for Second Chance to turn seven and said, you know, maybe when that happens, he'll be exactly the same as Chance.
And what happened?
Second Chance died early. He had stomach problems, couldn't digest his food.
That's interesting.
Been the case with some clones.
You mean stomach problems consistently with clones?
Dying early.
Not necessarily various stomach problems. Yeah.
And Ralph eventually came to see that, you know, it wasn't exactly the same animal back again.
Tell us about John Sperling and the role he played in the quest to clone dogs.
Okay. John Sperling is the founder of the University of Phoenix and a billionaire. I think he's considered the richest guy in Arizona anyway. And he funded the initial research at Texas A&M. It was him. And sort of just right after Dolly was announced in the newspapers, you know, he and his friend and her son were having breakfast, and sort of he just casually mentioned, you know, we should clone Missy, which was actually his friend and lover's dog, not his dog. And it sort of evolved from, you know, just a stray thought until, you know, let's really do this. So he assigned Lou Hawthorne to sort of investigate, go around to different universities and find out who might be willing to tackle it. And they ended up at Texas A&M, where he funded. And he ended up footing the bill for Chance and for Cats, which were cloned before dogs.
How much did he put in?
At least $20 million overall.
Now, let's go back to the woman who left you all those messages, her life story, and what you found out about her. But first, I mean, she was a person in need of a dog that could help her.
Right. Well, Joyce Burdan McKinney, woman from North Carolina, and which was one of the reasons we sort of hit it off when we first started talking, because I was from there too, and we were both, you know, dog crazy, and I had my dog's a therapy dog, and her dog was sort of a not an official service dog, but filled that role for her. What happened with her is she was living on a farm in North Carolina, and one day she found Booger, a pit bull, on the highway, and decided that she couldn't just take him to the shelter because pit bulls sometimes don't make it out of shelters in a good way. So she took him home. She also had a dog named Tough Guy, who was a mastiff and was purchased to be sort of a guard dog for her, because she lives sort of out in the country. And one day, the mastiff attacked her really badly, and she says, you know, actually amputated her hands or arm, but
not quite,
but yeah. it was a very serious thing. And Booger, she says, came to her rescue and fought off the dog that was five times bigger than him, got hurt badly in the process, and she was able to, you know, get up and drive down to her father's house nearby and get taken to a clinic, and then ambulance to a hospital in Winston-Salem, which turned out to be the same hospital I was born in. But after she went through a long period of rehabilitation and getting back on her feet, was actually in a wheelchair for a while, had several surgeries to get her hands and arms, you know,
working
normal
again,
and had a lot of therapy. And during that time, Booger, she says, became, you know, her assistant in everything. You know, he would help her when she fell down. He would help her up. She had a special harness made that she could, you know, he could help her out of the bathtub.
He'd open doors for
her. Yeah, she couldn't turn doorknobs at first, so he'd open and get her clothes out of the dryer and you know, assist her.
So she decides to have this dog cloned.
Well, initially, she actually wanted to clone the dog that maimed her.
Right.
And she actually called Ian Wilmot.
About that.
Yeah, the cloner of Dolly, and asked her about that. And he said, you know, dogs haven't been accomplished yet. She ended up getting Tough Guy stuffed and or mounted, to use the correct term. But she started thinking, you know, about, you know, maybe it will, by the time Booger dies or when he gets near the end, maybe scientists will have achieved cloning dog. So she had thought about it even before Booger died. And then when Booger died, she, like, took steps to have him, his body refrigerated and, you know, kept on ice so she could pursue that.
For how long?
She signed up. This sort of gets into the whole two companies that were competing aspect of it. But she signed up with the company that came out of the research being done at Texas A&M, the Sperling's company that was actually headed by Lou Hawthorne, who is the son of Sperling's longtime friend. And so he... I don't want to get too deep into the whole... I don't want to get too confused. It's a confusing subject.
But all I was asking was how long she kept that dog frozen.
Well, I think he still is, actually.
He still is.
Yeah, but she signed up with the American company, which was called Genetic Savings and Clone, which was Lou Hawthorne's company, and had a sample sent to that company.
John Weston Dick, and the book is titled Dog Inc., The Uncanny Inside Story of Cloning, Man's Best Friend. Let's open the phones. I think there are lots of folks who'd like to join us. If you'd like to join us on 800-433-8850. First to Keith in Gainesville, Florida. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
Fascinating subject.
Good.
I'm interested in the cost of actually having your dog DNA typed. I had Akita's, which your guest is somewhat familiar with because of his dog, for years. And my insurance company handed me a list for my homeowner's insurance. And on that list, Akita's, pit bulls, German Shepherds, Rottweilers, Cocker Spaniels, and Basset Hounds. And if you have any of those dogs, they would rate me higher.
What?
Yes. Or it, depending on the breed, some of them they just wouldn't insure you at all. And now this is in Florida. Maybe the laws are different elsewhere. So I'm looking at my precious Akita, who had been an aid dog to me when I had surgery, such as what you just described. And I said, well, I don't have any papers on her, so I don't know what she is. And they came out to assess the house and said, that looks like an Akita. And I said, yeah, it sure does. But I got no way to prove it unless you guys want to pay to do a DNA sample on her. And that pretty well put a stop to the issue. But I wanted to, you know, in terms of dog behavior, we have this whole nature versus nurture issue, which I assume he'll go into some in terms of making a decision to clone an animal and what's happened there. But I just wanted to point that out, that having your dog DNA typed could cost a lot more than just knowing what your dog is.
Like how much?
Well, it's not just Florida. I don't think it's all over. Certain breeds are being pinpointed and wrongly.
Cocker spaniels
can be, yeah. They're
temperamental.
They have bad reputations. And my dog, in all four breeds, and my dog, Rottweiler, Chow, Akita, and Pitbull, are, you know, are all on all the bad dog lists. And the bad dog lists, you know, change over the decades.
I see.
Used to be like Dobermans.
So what would you estimate the cost to be of having your dog's DNA?
The actual test is, there's several, and it's been improved over the years it's been out. But it's probably like 150 now. It was like 60 the first time I had it done. But now they can distinguish more breeds, and so the price keeps, you know, rising.
So $150.
Yeah, depending. There's like two different kinds. One, you can just swab your dog's cheek and send it in.
I see.
The other, they test the blood.
Yeah, and the other question becomes how reliable those DNA tests are.
I've heard from a lot of people who have, you know, little tiny dogs and are told it's, you know, German Shepherd, Mastiff, and they just say, no way. But, telling what nature's going to
So, Keith, are you about to do this with your dog?
No, my Akita, who lived a very healthy 14 years, which is a long time for that breed, passed some years ago. I then got a very high-end German Shepherd who was struck by lightning, and if I'd ever been tempted to clone a dog, it would have been her.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Keith. Well, thanks for calling, and we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care. On the web at aecf.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, investigating how U.S. guns end up in Mexico's drug wars, we talk with James Grimaldi, one of the reporters who has contributed to the Washington Post series, The Hidden Life of Guns. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And welcome back. As I talk with John Weston, Dick, by the way, let me spell his name for you. His last name, Weston, Dick, spelled WOESTENDIEK. And of course, that will be on our website. There are photographs in this book, one of Joyce Brennan McKinney. She holds up one of the clones from the dog we talked about earlier. She made the trip to South Korea to meet those dogs.
Twice. Well, she went to meet them shortly after their birth, and then several months later went back to take all five of them.
Take all five.
And that turned out not to go smoothly at all.
Why not? What happened?
Well, first there were delays because she still needed to come up with the money to pay for it, because she was
like $150,000.
That was the initial price, but she agreed to do publicity
for the South Korean company
in exchange for getting the price reduced to $50,000. But she didn't even have $50,000. Unlike most of the cloning customers, she wasn't wealthy.
So did she ever get the dogs?
She got the money together, or part of it, and they agreed to
take what she had.
Take the $30,000 and $20,000 later. She went over to get the dogs. Before she went, she got them all assistance dog certifications in quotes, because their dogs were really too young to have any sort of training. But her plan was, she didn't want the dogs flying in the plane's cargo area.
I see.
So she planned to go over there, try to take them all in the cabin with her, if that didn't work, to find people to pose as if they were
owners.
Handicapped.
Oh, I see.
And that didn't work too well either.
This gets messy.
It got very messy, and she was stuck there for a couple of weeks trying to get the dogs back. And
my God.
Eventually ended up, starting off doing it, taking one, flying over, flying back, getting another one.
Good grief.
Until the last two, she finally found people that would agree with her rules.
All right, let's go to Wayne, who's in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Good morning to you. Wayne, are you there? All right, we'll go to Marion in Rochester, New York. Good morning.
Good morning, Diane. Very interesting show.
Good.
I would just like to ask, as this process evolves, how has the health and the personality of these animals withstood the test of time?
Well, I think it's still got a lot more evolving to do, as there's been so few. Maybe last figure I heard, maybe 20 dogs had clones had actually been delivered to customers.
I see.
More than hundreds of dogs have been cloned, mostly in connection with laboratory work.
But John, what strikes me is, aren't people looking for exact replicas? And there is no way one could guarantee an exact replica personally. I mean, your dog is your dog. He is your dog because he's lived with you for these years, developed that kind of personality with the interaction. Not to say you couldn't eventually develop the same kind of relationship, but surely it can't be the same dog.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think it's more nurture than nature in what a dog becomes. I mean, our dogs, in a way, sort of become us, which in turn, leads us to the sort of emotions that might lead somebody to want to clone one. But I put more stock in the nurture side of it.
And even thinking about twins.
Mm-hmm.
Human twins.
Which is what clones are, twins.
And how different they are. I mean, goodness gracious. All right, let's go to Peninsula, Ohio. Good morning, Ellen.
Good morning. There were two things that struck me while I was listening to earlier in the show when you were first describing how the first dog was cloned. One was a little bit of sadness hearing about the life of the cloned dog, of course. But the one that struck me more, and I was surprised at my reaction, was when you said that they use electricity to make the cells start to divide. It just brought me right back to Dr. Frankenstein and how they were on the right track, with raising him up and getting the lightning on him. It just kind of amused me.
Yeah, that's sort of the one part of the process that I think jolts, no pun intended, most people, is that, they have to, that electricity is involved, and otherwise it's all, pretty organic and just cells being shifted and moved around, and that's to get to fuse and then start dividing, but
yeah,
it is a little Frankenstein-y.
Yeah.
To me, anyway, being a layman.
Right, me too. All right, thank you.
Thank you, and to Hooks at New Hampshire. Hi there, Ray. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you.
Go right ahead, sir.
Okay. We've been talking about the nature versus nurture argument, and wouldn't it have been in the Koreans' best interest to ask the student of the donor to raise the clone dog to kind of show the correlation between their personalities, especially if they're trying to market a product?
You mean to raise the dog in the same kind of environment?
Yeah,
just like we've been talking about, to show that you can nurture the dog to try to raise the same dog that is possible, rather than, I mean, like you said, you can make a twin dog, but it's not going to be the same as you raise in a laboratory.
Right, and that would be interesting, and that's pretty much the case with some of the customers who have received clones of their dogs. They are attempting to, you know, raise them in the same environment and nurture them the same way. But it reminds me of the movie. It's mentioned in the book, the 1978, I think, movie The Boys from Brazil, in which the IR-11 book, which Hitler is cloned, and in addition to cloning the 80 Hitlers or something like that, they also place them all in families that are, you know, designed to be exactly the same as the ones he grew up in an attempt to get the same being again.
Doesn't happen. That's all there is to it. Here's an email from a listener saying, I assume cats can be cloned, or is it only dogs being cloned in Korea, or at least a majority, and why do you think that is?
Cats actually were cloned before dog, and again were another result of the attempt to clone dog. It was at Texas Texas A&M University. After working on a dog for a while, they started getting a lot of calls from cat owners, and they decided to try and clone a cat. And cats were, and most animals, all animals were easier to clone than dogs, because dogs, their egg cells are opaque. You can't really see through them, so it's harder to manipulate. Manipulate is the word they use. And they also only go into heat like once, twice a year. Cats were achieved, I don't remember the year right offhand, but the first cat was named CC, short for carbon copy. And it was actually a pretty huge factor in how things took place, because it was a clone of a calico cat, and calico cats have this genetic weirdness about them.
And the coloring.
Yeah, yeah. And so the actual clone of the cat wasn't the same color as the original cat, which didn't bother the scientists at all, because they were saying, you know, it's a genetic duplicate still. But it very much bothered Genetic Savings and Clone, the company that was trying to market
Genetic Savings and Clone.
It's a pretty witty
name.
Give
me a break. You write about a dog named Tracker, whose owner won a contest to have him cloned. Tell us about Tracker.
Well, what happened was Genetic Savings and Clone, after succeeding with cats, eventually shut down, went out of business. Then they came back as BioArts International. And in that, they started off with, they weren't able to clone a dog themselves, but they ended up hooking up with one of the two lead scientists on the Snuppy project, who had since left Seoul National University, was fired actually. But they hooked up with him, and he started cloning the dogs, which they were, and the American company was marketing them. And so they started off with, they announced an online cloning auction, and we're going to take the top five bidders who wanted their dogs cloned. And sort of in conjunction with that, when they did that, they started hearing from people who were complaining that, you know, it's not right that only rich people can clone their dogs. I should be able to clone my dog too. Which Lou Hawthorne, you know, didn't really see the logic in that, but sort of decided, because of that concern, that he would do a free dog cloning, and they'd have like an essay contest, and people could write about why their dog was the most clone-worthy dog in the world, and they would clone that dog for free. And so the winner of that, who was actually an earlier, had his dog's sales banked at Genetic Savings and Clone, so he was an earlier customer. The winner was a man named James Symington, who used to be a police officer
in Nova Scotia, and then became moved to California and was an actor for a while. But while he was a police officer, he had a dog named Tracker, police dog, who was very exceptional. And
German Shepherd?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, from Czechoslovakia.
Uh-huh.
And had the dog had a very distinguished police career and then retired. But then on 9/11, his owner saw, what was going on TV and decided, he had started thinking, what can I do? And says he looked down at his dog and said, that's what I can do. So he took his dog to Ground Zero and started joining in the search there without authorization either from his police department or New York police department. But Mr. Symington claims that his dog Tracker found the last survivor of 9/11.
Is Tracker still living?
No. Tracker, after Symington won the contest, the essay contest, Tracker was still alive at that time, but he died a few months before the clones arrived.
I see. But the clones are surviving?
Yeah. And again, there were five of them. Again, it's, since it's the sort of thing they do a lot of, sort of the scattershot approach, they, see how many, they do the process as often as they can in hopes of getting, one exact match. So there's often surplus clones. But he took all five, just like Bernan took all five of hers.
The book is titled Dog Ink, The Uncanny Inside Story of Cloning Man's Best Friend, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. How many cloning operations currently exist?
Just one that actually does the cloning, and it's
and
in Korea.
How much? Oh, it's in Korea. Yeah. There are none here in the United States.
No, there's companies you can go through. There's lots of companies you can bank your dog's genes at, but the only place that's cloning dogs now is RNL Bio.
And what are they charging these days?
It's now down to $100,000.
$100,000. Good grief. Okay, let's go to Sebring, Florida. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Hi, I just had a comment about, the whole idea of cloning, how maddening it is when you think about all the dogs, we'll only talk about dogs, that are being euthanized every year, and all these dogs that, need a home, but here's someone who's going to spend $100,000 to clone a dog that will never be like their dog. Anyway, it's just a comment.
An excellent comment, I think, and then a point I hope the book makes is that, if you want an exact copy of your dog, you can probably find him, through at a shelter somewhere waiting. I'd have to agree with that.
I mean, the fact of the matter is people are looking for exact replicas, and it's not to be had.
Yeah.
But they keep looking.
They do, and I did that myself. Went through I've had a bunch of dogs, my ex-wife's dog when we were married was a dog named Augie, who was kind of black, wiry coated, medium sized dog, scruffy look. And when Augie died, we went to the shelter and got a dog that greatly resembled her. And then when that dog Hobo died, we went to the shelter and got another one that looked a lot alike. I think looks wise, you can find pretty much close to the same thing in your local shelter.
You just said the key word, looks wise, but not necessarily temperamentally.
Right.
That's exactly the same. And that's what, in part, people are looking for. Well, it does strike me that, I was fascinated to read these stories of people who've pursued this kind of ideal that exists in their own mind about their pets. We all love our pets, but I gather even as of early 2010, There's a man who operates a spy gear shop in Los Angeles, was waiting for the clone of his Yorkshire Terrier Schnauzer mix, Wolfie, who died in 2009. Did he get his dog yet?
He's, as of a couple weeks ago, was still waiting. He's actually getting his two dogs cloned, Wolfie and Bubble. And he, when I talked to him, he actually thought, we didn't know if he thought it, but he held out the possibility that his original dog souls will enter his clones.
John West and Dick. The book is titled Dog Ink, The Uncanny Story Inside Story of Cloning Man's Best Friend. Fascinating, John. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Dori Annisman answers the phones.